the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Bud Barnes is the Dean Emeritus of the School of Business, having first arrived in September 1973. Bud took the business school from the basement of the administration building, now called College Hall, to its own home, the Jepson Center, on the shores of Lake Arthur, and ushered in accreditation and an increase in national profile. He remains a part of the SBA community teaching economics.
Okay, so today I have the School of Business legend, our very own Clarence Harold Bud Barnes, Dean Emeritus of Gonzaga School of Business, and really we're situated in the Jepson Center, which we like to call the house that Bud built. And he's done a lot of things to move our business school from the basement of the admin building. I still call it the admin building. To our own home and to accreditation at the highest level with the AACSB over your 50 years now. You just celebrated your 50th year.
Going into my 51st.
Yeah, at Gonzaga. And we could probably talk for hours about a number of things. So we're going to actually focus this.
We could talk for hours just about your grandfather.
That too. And we have some ideas for maybe some other podcast episodes. But today, we're just talking about kind of your time here, your tenure at Gonzaga. And if I could, Bud, just kind of give some bullet points up front to kind of get them out of the way for expediency. You're from Ohio. Mm-hmm. You did an MBA at Xavier. That was kind of your first exposure to Jesuit education. Mm-hmm. PhD in economics, University of Tennessee. And then you found Gonzaga. You came over as a professor.
I did. I came as an assistant professor. Correct.
And what year was that?
1973. September of 73.
Moves out to Spokane and becomes a faculty member and successful at that. But it wasn't too long before Father Coughlin asked you to be the dean. Is that correct?
7 years later.
Mm-hmm. So just 7 years. So you were probably just a recent associate and tenured.
I was tenured, but I may have just been promoted to associate. I can't remember. Yeah, probably had just been. Yeah, I think after 5 years or 6 years, I'd gone up. You're right.
Mm-hmm. So about that time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Correct.
And you were what we call the reluctant dean, right? Because you weren't thinking originally that.
No, I didn't apply for the job. We went through two failed searches at Andrew. When I say failed, we had 2 years of interim deans because we would go out nationwide looking for someone, and we didn't succeed. And that's when the faculty went to Father Coughlin and said, "We may have the guy here in the house that can do the job, and you should talk to him." And that was when I was contacted.
And so what did Barney say?
You know, it's kind of interesting. That's a good question you ask. No one's ever asked that of me, but I have thought about it. He said that the faculty had come to see him and that they really would like to meet with me and determine if he felt that I would be a good candidate to take that job. And so he kind of laid out what he was expecting. And Father Coughlin pulled no punches. He wanted that school accredited. He did not mention a new building at the time, but accreditation was big on his list. He had come from St. Louis University, another Jesuit school. And it was accredited, and he knew how important it was to him as the president, as the new president, to get our school accredited.
And so that was his orders. Now, was your response? I don't know, Barney. I don't know if I can. This is my gig. I'm here to teach.
That was exactly what I said. I said, you know, I didn't come here to be an administrator. I'm a professor. I like my job. I think I do a good job. I'm an economist. I've got a number of projects I went through a whole litany of things. And he said, well, let's do this. Why don't you, let's give it a week. Why don't you take a few days? And he said, let's get back together. And we set a date. And he said, I'll put together some ideas and thoughts that I have. And I said, that would be fine. That gives me a little time. So I went home. And the first thing I did was put together a list of pros and cons about taking the job. If I take it, what are the advantages of taking it? And what are the disadvantages? And then he and I met about 4 days later. And I laid out what I thought would be what I could do, which I think he agreed with me. And then I also pointed out the misgivings I had about that. I was young. I was just a puppy, to be honest. And I told him I didn't have experience. I had never been in management or administration. It wasn't something that I was looking to do. But he kind of looked beyond those things. And then we got down to, if I take the job, what my salary would be. I made some conditions that I wanted to retain my title as a tenured professor. So I was tenured. I wanted to know that I had qualified for a sabbatical, but because I would be taking this job, I wouldn't get the sabbatical that I wanted. And he said, not to worry. He said, take it for 3 years. And if it all works out, then he says, and we'll make sure I'll guarantee your sabbatical. And I wanted 5 weeks vacation, and we settled on four.
Yeah, that's
a good and just a number of it was a good discussion. He was absolutely mesmerizing one on one. He had me in the palm of his hand, and so I took the job.
You know, it was explained to me once, and I could sense it that some of those guys, and Barney being one of them, you could actually sense the presence of God. You know, the energy and the power and the charisma. And
I think you're absolutely right, Andrew. Yeah. I think they, most of them, bring with them. It's a sense of godly peace, but also authority that you respect. At least I did.
Right, right. And for a Lutheran, that's pretty good, right?
A Methodist,
sorry.
Although my mother was solid Catholic. My father was the son of a Methodist minister.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up in one of those families where we were Protestant and Catholic at the same time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was not easy on a child. My parents, bless their hearts, I can't believe how, because in those days, and that goes back 70 years for them to take that marriage between a Catholic and a Protestant, neither of whom wanted the other to be married, families, and to make that work. And I never saw an argument in all of my years between the two over religion. It's just great.
Wow.
Just great.
Now, if I wanted to bring this up, and you don't have to answer it, but you told me once how you got the nickname Bud.
Yes.
You want to share that? You want to share that?
Well, my parents had a dog, and they called the dog Buddy for some reason. I don't know how it got its name. And I think the dog died. And then I came along, and I became the Buddy, I guess, in the family. I had an older brother and an older sister, but I became Buddy. And I asked my mom and dad one time, I said, how did I get the name Bud or Buddy? And they told me, they said, well, we named you after this dog we love so much and we missed.
Well, that's incredible. So, yeah. That's great. So now you're dean, and that, I guess that's around, is that around 80?
1980. Yeah. I took over, I think, in March of 80.
And what does that mean at that point? You just moved to the next cubicle in the admin building?
I had moved over. It was from one bad office to another bad office.
In the basement.
They were just cubby holes. And that was my start. And and the budget was absolutely zero. I mean, I had nothing to work with. And the university was dead broke at the time.
Yeah.
It was tough.
So what's your, and it's not like you have a playbook on how to be dean. So what do you do?
Well,
your first move?
Yeah. The first thing I did was to start understanding what needed to be done to become an accredited school. And Father Coughlin, he sent me to the AACSB annual meeting, and I was able to meet with some people in accreditation, and they laid out for me and gave me literature and what was expected. It was almost like a template of what you have to do to become an accredited school. And they all kind of rolled their eyes, knowing that we only, at that time, we only had like 15 faculty.
Wow.
We were small. And, but Barney put me on that kind of that track. And that was my, so, and then I came back, and after doing my homework, I went in and I told him, I said, I'm going to need $500,000. And he said, $500,000? I said, yes. And he said, what for? And this is back, keep in mind, this is in 1981 or two. And I said, I need faculty who are doctorally qualified. I need a library that is comparable in terms of holdings to the core library at Harvard. Not as big, but in substance. And a number of other things. I needed computers, and I laid out what I had to have. And he said, oh, boy. So the first thing he did was agree to go ahead and build the library, the business holdings in the library. And I moved on that. And then gradually he started allowing me to find, source out faculty. I had to let four faculty go who were not tenured and were not doctorally qualified, because we just could not get the accreditation without the scholarly research and productivity. So that was tough to let people go. And one left and came back, bless her heart. She got her PhD, came back, and was a wonderful professor. But three of them didn't. They left and did not come back. And then a couple retired. So I was able to build a good cadre the faculty, and we took it up to about 18 or 19 in about 4 years.
Wow.
And that put us in pretty good shape. And then the next thing was, you know, the building, getting it done. And the nice thing is the faculty brought research with them and were doing scholarly work. And then taking that scholar, I call it teacher scholar, taking that scholarly work into the classroom and helping, you know, develop their own discipline areas. And it was, it married up very well. And we had some good fortunate hires. I hired some new wonderful faculty. Larry Lewis came, Jerry Monks came, just people that could really get the job done and do it well. Larry Wright came in finance, executive in residence, but not as a, he was just on an annual contract, but did a beautiful job with investments. And so it just tended to work, it worked well. And so.
And then at some point you outgrow your location in the ad building.
Yeah. Well, I put together a board. That was one of the things that I was advised to do by AACSB. Bring in some stakeholders that know your school and can help support you. Because, you know, I had mentioned that I didn't have much outside, you know, support money. And they said, you need to start reaching out to people. So I built the board. And during that time, the question came up of housing. You know, as we were growing, we were running out of space in the bottom of the college hall, the administration building. And I brought a fellow up. I didn't bring him up. One of our trustees did, and that introduced me to him. His name was Bob Jepson. And somehow Bob and I just hit it off. And I think then about a month or two later, he came for a couple of days, and we just spent some quality time together. And then about a month later, he said he was going to be back in the Northwest, and he would love to come back by. And he did. And we spent a day together and a night, and then the next day. And then I was taking him to the airport. And he said, you know, we got to get you out of that basement of that building. That's a horrible place for faculty. And he was, you know, how, and Bob was he was working for a fellow who had the one of the big finance investment companies in New York that was virtually taken down by the World Trade Center when it was bombed.
Oh, wow.
something Fitzgerald. Now, there's their company still around. Bernice. Anyway, he worked for them. But Bob made a lot of money, and he said, we've got to get you out of that basement. And he said, I think we need to build you a building. I said, wow, what a, that, I agree.
I accept.
There's on the way to the airport. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I'll put together a committee, and will you chair it? He said, I'll chair it. And he said, we'll get it done. We had raised, between Bob and a couple of his friends, we raised about $4 million in about 2 months. And that was, so I went to see Father Coughlin. And I said to him, I said, Father, we want to build a building. And he said, I said, we've already got, I told him. He said, he looked up at me and he's in his magical way. And he said, that's gonna be a good addition, bud. He said, that'll be just great. And I said, thank you. Then he said, and I thought it was all over. And he said, but wait a minute. He said, I have three conditions. He said, one, I want a Spokane architect. I want a Spokane contractor. And he said, you're not going to turn a wheel until you have all the money in the bank. That was his three conditions.
Wow.
And I, without hesitation, I said, that'll be fine. We'll do it. And with Bob's help. And just then I started just reaching out to people, members of my board. And the generosity was wonderful. We had that money raised. It took us about a year, and we raised it all with his start.
And you broke ground. Was the building completed, the original 86?
We started in 85, and it took us about 14 months, and it was opened in the fall of 86.
Can you share the price tag of the original?
It was just under $8 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Think about how much of a building like that cost today,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, then we doubled the size of it 20 years later, and that was $12 million. So, but it was a great building for the time that we had it. And when AACSB came, when the visitation team came the first time, they were totally impressed, blown away by the building for a small school like ours.
Yeah.
And tip my hat to Bob Jepson, because he said, let's build you a building. And I said, wow.
Wow.
I'm all in.
Yeah.
And Bob followed up with gift after gift after gift. Not only to the School of Business, but to the university. I mean, if you look at some of the student apartments that are around campus, Bob Jepson's, his name isn't on them, but his money is on them. The Foley Center, the Kennedy Apartments, the Dussault Apartments all have Bob Jepson's money behind them.
What was his connection to Gonzaga?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Bob had graduated from the University of Richmond, but for some reason, Gonzaga just was it was a home away from home for him. It was private. He felt that the tax-supported universities had their own source of money, and he's at the state level, state universities, and he said, "I want to support you." Gonzaga, meaning you, Gonzaga. And boy, he did. And he on top of that, he would give me 60,000 after we were built and running. He came back and he said, here's what I'd like to do. I want to give $3,000 student scholarships a year. Each student will get 3,000. I want to give 6 faculty research fellowships a year. Each faculty member will get 3,000 on top of their salary. And I'll do that every year you need the money. And we did it for about 15 years.
Wow.
He paid and he wrote the check, never hesitated. Every time we would talk or visit, he'd say, what do you need? What do you need? And I got to the point where I said, Bob, you've done enough. You've done already enough. It's, you know, I can't thank you anymore than I have.
That's incredible.
And so,
What was on the site before Jepson was here?
This was a part of the McGoldrick Lumber Company, and this was a lumber yard here up where we are, and it stretched around Lake Arthur, and as McGoldrick's closed down the lumber yard, it became somewhat derelict, and the university buildings and maintenance took over some of the space. And used it for storage, and it was just old, old lumber barns where they used to keep lumber under roof. And then Central Premix, the cement company, would use the area where the Junt Museum is, and they would drive their trucks over and dump their cement, their day's waste, into the Lake Arthur.
Oh, wow.
And if you go over there, there's probably 30 feet of cement over in that area where they dumped it and dumped it. And I used to watch them bring those trucks in. They'd do 3 and 4 at night would come in there, and you'd see them raise those things, and the slush would come running out. And,
wow.
No one, in those days, there was no environmental issues.
Right.
But, yeah.
Kind of crazy.
Yeah, but this was a derelict place. If I may, you ask a good question. I had hired an architect, and they assigned one of their junior designers to the building, to do the building. And he had selected a place over behind Hughes, Hughes Hall, the science building, where we now have, I think, that new engineering, and there was a little art museum there as well, the little hut that looked down.
And
we were up, and Bob was here one time, and we were driving around there with the architect and looking at this, and he says, here's where I think we want to do it. We're going to cut it into the bank, and you're going to look out across the Spokane River. And Bob looks at the space, and it was kind of overgrown at the time. And he looked back, and at Hughes Hall, where they had the greenhouse, there were probably four big dumpsters back there.
Oh, boy.
And he said, wait a minute, stop. And he says, you're going to put my building in front of the garbage collection or whatever, however he said it. And Val said, well, yeah, we can probably arrange to have that covered. And Bob said, no. We're not going to put that building here. He said, that's crazy. And he was adamant, no. So we started coming around the back of, at the time, Jesuit House. And we saw the old McGoldrick space. And this was a nice, flat piece of land. And he said, stop. And he said, let's get out and take a look. And we got out. And he could see Jesuit House. And then he could look down toward the downtown. He said, put his foot down. He said, right here. We're going to build it right here. And there was no hesitation. I said, absolutely. And then the architect was a little bit taken by it in a negative way. And I went to my friend who was the principal, who I'd gone to, and we interviewed to do the job. And I said, Ron Tan was his name.
Yeah, I knew Ron, yeah.
Yeah, and I said, Ron, whoever the architect was, it's not working. He's the cooperation isn't there, and I'm not getting the from him what I need. And he said, all right. He said, what do you want? I said, I want what you presented when you came to present your case, and we hired you.
Yeah.
I want you to design the Jepson Center. And he said, you're going to give it. I'll design it for you. And then he said, what do you want in it? And I said, well, I want people to think when they walk into the Jepson Center, they're walking into a business headquarters. It's a business building. And he said, I'll give it to you. And he did. It was a great building. And still is to this day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he did other buildings on campus.
He did the Foley. He did the Junt. He did a rebuild of the Jesuit House.
Interesting.
A great architect. He really, really was. Came from Singapore.
Yeah. He has some stories too.
I think he did.
During World War II.
Yes.
I think his family was spared because they worked for a Japanese company or some story
is
about that.
That right? Yeah, I did not know that. Yeah. You know, he lives right across the street from your uncle.
Yeah, they sold. I don't know where they
I don't know where. I think they're in a retirement community.
And that sounds about so. Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ron's gotten up in years.
Yeah.
What a great guy, though.
Great guy. So doors open, 86,
mm-hmm.
and then accreditation was coming 89, soon after.
89, I think, 88.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about 3 years later, years later.
And for those listening, I mean, we have what I would call the gold standard of accreditation, the AACSB.
Yeah.
We have it in two. We have it for business and then specifically for accounting.
Oh, absolutely.
Well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Which is a double gold. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know what, I mean, it's probably over 100 schools have that, but that represents, I think, the top half of a percent of business schools worldwide, maybe even a smaller number than that.
I think you're right. Yeah, it's in that vicinity,
yeah,
that neighborhood.
something tight like that. So, okay, so you're building up, you have the faculty, you have facilities, you have the library. We get the accreditation. Mm-hmm. So we're trucking along. What's the faculty numbers by now? We're talking late 80s.
Yeah, probably 26, 27. Okay. We didn't hit the really big numbers of need in terms of need until about till after Father Colgan had retired and Father Spitzer came. And Father Spitzer had said, brought the deans in, all of us, and he said, we're a top quintile school. And he said, I'm not used to teaching in quintile schools. He says, we're going to make Gonzaga a top decile school, and you're going to do it, all of you. He looked at all the deans. And boy, I just jumped at the chance. And so it took me about, I don't know, a month or two to put together more needs that I had. And I said, and then just the way in which he presented the university to make it look like it was, you know, truly a top decile school. Yeah. We started seeing the enrollments jump.
Wow.
They went from 450 to 550 to 6 to 1,000.
To the freshman classes, right?
Yeah, the freshman classes coming in.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't hesitate. When I would go in, I hit with him and the vice president of academics. And I'd say, I need two more people in this discipline and another person here. Okay, well, why don't we do this? Let's see how much it's going to cost you and go ahead and let's see if we can get them hired. And the nice thing is, as our reputation began to grow, quality faculty were seeking us out rather than we having to seek them. In fact, there was a young kid that we knew who was working for an accounting firm over in Seattle, who had been over here on a recruitment trip for his firm.
True.
And the Professor Weber came to me while he was here, and he said, I'd mentioned to this young man that we're going to be looking for a tax specialist if he happens to know one. And this fellow happened to have his terminal doctoral degree in tax and a law degree and a master's degree. And I said, who is it? And he said, his name's Andrew Brasich. And I said, make him an offer right now. Make him an offer. And we did. And we hired you right then.
That was, it was quite the series of events. Yeah. I was actually in the office that morning early, you know, accounting firm. And I had no, I mean, I love what I was doing. I was in the international tax, and a partner walks by my desk and he says, hey, you went to Gonzaga. I said, yeah. And he said, I need someone to go do interviews over there. How about you go for it? What's your schedule look like? And I was on flying out an hour and a half out of SeaTac. I think it was late for the first interview. And then what happened was we had lunch with the faculty in 210, Jefferson, mm-hmm. 210. And I sat next to Eddie Beer. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of a catch up. You know, it's been 10 years, 15, 13 years or something like that. And he said, you know, with your LLM, you're academically qualified and we're hiring for a tax prof. And he said, go talk to Weber. And then I talked to Gary. And at that time, we had just made an offer to a woman who was exceptional. She actually went on to be the dean, I think, at Bucknell. And Gary thought, she's going to say yes. We had a good, you know, bummer we missed it or whatever, but I'll keep you posted. And then like 2 weeks later, she said no. I think a week after that, I was on campus.
Yeah.
That was around Halloween, and I was in the classroom in January. Absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely
no, terrifying. I know, but it was a great find and a great fit.
I appreciate that.
When he came to me, Gary was, I think, my associate dean at the time and running the accounting program.
Yeah.
And when he came to me, of course, he and I have been pretty tight from day one. But when he came to me, I remember when your name came up, I said, oh, my goodness. I said, I was so angry at that kid that you didn't set for the CPA before you left.
That's true.
And I said, I told your grandfather, I said, if I could find him, I said, I would take a whip to him.
And we had a heck of a class that year. They used to rank you. And I think we had in the state 4 or 5 of the top 10.
Yeah.
On that exam. The reason I didn't was because, and I actually started the prep, and then I was looking at the rules. I had decided to go to law school. I had a job with Ernst & Young, but I decided to go to law school instead. And you can't get your license without a year of experience.
Oh, I did not know.
So even if I were to pass,
you would have had to
it didn't mean much. Yeah, or you got to work for the firm. Yeah. But I came back about 10 years later and got it. So.
Yeah.
So it worked out. Yeah, in the end.
No, it did. Well, you went from what, Boston down to Florida, if I'm not mistaken. Florida.
Yeah.
And you kept right on going from Boston on, didn't you?
Yep. Florida. I mean, I spent some time in Atlanta.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then ultimately back in Seattle and back, came full circle.
Yeah. Now, had you not even worked for Deloitte at the time when you went to law, when you first left to go to Boston?
Yeah, no, I was, yeah, no, I had, a, I actually did, and I don't like to tell people this, but since we're friends here, I'll admit it. I was an EY in audit at the time.
Is that right?
Yeah. Before I got my senses.
Yeah. Well, for those who are listening to this, Andrew, you probably have given up $1 million a year to take a job for about $150,000 a year. So I want you to know that you might be as happy, but you're not going to be as rich.
That's right. I get summers off, right? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, knowing you, you don't, because I'm in here every day and you're always here.
That's true.
Anyway.
I feel like, Bud, a lot of your tenure here has to do with relationships. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're a guy that establishes quality relationships with the business community, with your faculty, with the students, particularly probably when you were, you know, in the classroom a lot more. Now you're back in the classroom. Can we talk about some of those? I mean, and it could be Mark Pigott. You talked a little bit about Bob Jepson already. I know there's quite a few. How does this come about? If you just want to kind of walk us through an example of something.
I think it doesn't come about immediately. I think for me, I never looked upon the job I had, which was at the time, because of the size and the needs we had, was about 50% building relationships and raising money. And I found out early on that you just don't walk into someone's office once or twice or three times and then put a case before them and ask them for $500,000. It just doesn't work that way. What you do, what I did, was I looked upon people as developing a relationship without putting dollar signs to it. I had board members who would give me money and people. In fact, I just got a check today from someone for my scholarship fund for $500, unsolicited. Good friend. But the point is, what I did was I started building, I think, friendships. And I'm not a total extrovert, but I would see in students after they would leave and I would somehow make a contact with them, what potential they had. And I liked to really capitalize on their potential. And if you look at the names that are on the offices or on the rooms, especially in the new edition, those are, for the most part, people who I've gotten to know over the years and who, to this day, are wonderful friends. I mean, we share lots of dinners, lots of evenings, weekends. It just goes on and on. I don't know what it is. It's like Bob Jepson. It's like Mark Pigott. It's like Don Barbieri or so many, you know,
Fritz Wolf.
Fritz Wolf, my goodness gracious. So, and, you know, we literally do vacations together and travel together. And there's just been, and out of that comes, I think, what I have experienced at Gonzaga must rub off. The magic dust trickles around or something. And all of a sudden, they want to be a part of that. Not because I have my hand out or I've got it on their wallet. It's because they just think that being a part of Gonzaga is really special. And then they're, what can I do? How can I help? Where are you going to need this? What? So, and I would ask, but I'll tell you a quick story. When we were doing the second edition, I went down to see Joe Albertson, who was the founder of Albertson Supermarkets. And I went in to see him, and bless his heart, he was a wonderful, gentle man. And I laid out, I think I was asking him for $100,000. It could have been 50. I don't remember now. But I put the case out to him, and I said, you know, that you opened your first store in Spokane. I did a little research in history. You opened your first store in Spokane outside of Boise. And I said, you know, you have a footprint in Boise or in Spokane. And it's your stores are so well liked. And I flowered him up and all of that. He then ends up taking me to lunch in Boise, and then drives me to the airport, and I fly home. And he said, well, I'll get back to you. So about 2 weeks later, I think his secretary called, or I can't remember, there was a connection made. I may have called her for all I know. But anyway, 3 weeks later, I'm back down there. And we're in his office again and talking, and things are going well and for everybody. And he said, well, I know why you're here. He said, and he opens his desk drawer, and he reaches in, and he brings out a sheet of paper, and stapled onto it is a check. And he slides it over to me, and the check is for $1,000. And he said, this may not be what you're looking for. Well, Father Coughlin had taught me, bless his heart, that all gifts are good gifts. And I thought, gosh, Joe, you could have built the whole school and never blinked an eye. But I took that check and brought it home. I never saw him again after that. He didn't live too much longer, but it was just one of those nice relationships.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So anyway, I look upon relationships and former students and business people that I engage with as being not just, you know, slam bam, thank you. Right. It's more let's get to know each other.
Sure.
And that's
sure.
What I do. And I like that. I have I'm having coffee tomorrow morning with one of our major donors. And it's just one of those wonderful experiences where we'll have a bite to eat and a cup of coffee together and go on our way. And he's done a wonderful job supporting the school. Yeah. Oh, he did. Not anymore. But he did. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. We did the addition. Was it 06? They did the addition.
We started it in 05, and you know, exactly 20 years later, we put the addition on. Same size. We doubled the size of the building. It was first building was 32,000, I believe, square feet. The addition was 32,000. So
wow.
Yeah.
And now I think we're around the time that you stepped down as dean. You're still teaching probably around 44, 46 faculty.
44 or 45 faculty, yeah. And really quality people.
Right.
Really good faculty. Yeah.
From, you know,
it's amazing, do you think, in a group of 45, it's like a class of 35. You're going to have six or seven who are going to excel, and you're going to have two or three that are going to struggle. And I don't know, among our faculty, we don't have many strugglers, and that's 45. Today, maybe 47, 48, I don't know.
We need another extension. We're another extension.
Yeah, we're adding. We're still growing.
Yeah, so I don't know where we go from here, I guess.
Yeah. We tried to do that, by the way, with the addition.
I heard someone talked about it. And why didn't they do that? Why it was just...
Because we would have lost the use of the entire second floor to put a tower, or that they would have had to have taken the roof off. And we couldn't have... That we were advised, this will not work. Because where are you going to put everybody?
Right.
You've got 44 faculty. And when you start to take the roof off, you lose all these offices. And we just couldn't find a place to put them. We were so crowded at the time. So we just simply pushed everything out and did what we did. And quite honestly, I think it gave us a better building.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fantastic building. So especially as you were talking, we're in my office now.
Yeah.
The great view I have, though, I'm going to make a request, Bud, that we trim back some of these trees.
I know, yeah. Well, that's,
view
yeah.
Of the,
you know, that's a funny story, because when we did the first building, we literally had to take out trees. And even back in the 80s, mid-80s, I had a couple of students who were very environmentally conscious. And they came to me and were critical of the fact that I allowed these three or four trees to be taken out. And so we, I said, we're going to, trees are replaceable. We're going to plant new trees. Well, now they got planted blocking the view.
Well, there's even a time, you know, and it's quite the, quite the ecosystem down there. You talked about Lake Arthur, you know, getting some, I think they've done a lot to clean it up.
Oh yeah.
And it's pretty vibrant. And there was a time, this wasn't too long ago, probably in the last 10 years, I was talking to some of the plant services folks. There were beavers there.
Oh yeah.
And the beavers were chewing down the trees. And there was kind of a, well, do we get rid of the beavers? Yeah. Well, they belong here, but the trees provide shade for the fish. There was a big hubbub. I don't know. I guess I don't see any trees.
I haven't seen any trees fall.
Yeah, really. As of late. Yeah, yeah.
So. But it's a great place to build a dam. There's a, for a beaver dam. Yeah. There's no doubt about
it. Perfect. It's perfect. And I'm guessing it's
connected. You know, that's a funny thing, too. One time I was down there and there was some of that cement that the water level was down, and there were probably five or six little turtles up on there sunbathing on that. And I thought, wow, that's got to get hot and so forth. So I went and I found about a 6 or 7 inch round log, about 10 feet long. And I put it on the back end of my pickup truck. And in the dark of night, I came down here and I pushed it off and floated it in the lake. And about 4 or 5 days later, I'm looking out my window, and there's maybe 10 turtles up on that log. Wow. I guess they enjoy the sun, but it was floating out in Lake Arthur. Yes. Someone came along eventually and snared it. Took it, but
sure. It's kind of shifting to the some of the management side of the role of Dean. We talked a little bit about the external facing. One thing I think we have unique here in Jepson is we don't have departments, we have disciplines. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of your thought process behind that? And I know that one time there was some different groupings of departments and
there was.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question and a good lead in. When I took over as dean, we did have departments. We were very small. We're 2 and 3 faculty in each department. And one of the things that I looked at with accreditation is if you've got a 2-person department and you lose one, you've lost 50% of your faculty. That doesn't work. And AACSB made that very clear. Secondly, I had just finished reading a book called In Search of Excellence, called by Peters and Waterman, in which they were very critical of business schools because business schools tended to build silos, and it would be the marketing faculty on one side and the management on the other. Then you had finance and you had operations and whatever, and they weren't working together. And the idea was, this is not healthy for business, because usually people who get hired into business don't stay in the same profession or discipline area forever. And so taking that and transitioning it over to what we were doing here in the business school, my thought was, get rid of these silos. Take them away. They're not of value. We're teaching an undergraduate business curriculum, and the only one that really requires its own identity is accounting, because it's a licensing end to a career development. Not that they stay in accounting all their life either, but the point is, to get that license, you need to be an accountant. And so my thought was, let's just simply get rid of these departments as we know them, and let's have just a school at the undergraduate level. And so I kind of put that to the faculty, and I think some of them had read In Search of Excellence. I don't know, but the point being, we voted as a faculty to eliminate departments per se. Mm-hmm. Now we created them. We have are called leads, and we still have disciplines, but. But we also agreed that we created out of that concentrations. So a student, instead of having a degree in marketing with 21 hours, could have a concentration in marketing with 12 hours. It wouldn't be the full major. it would be a concentration. So the majors went away. The major was in business administration with maybe a concentration in economics and finance, or maybe in entrepreneurship and operations management, or maybe in accounting and finance, or so that you could have more than one concentration, and not because you were only being required to have 24 credit hours in that major to be considered a major in that field. And what you really were, your major was business administration. And so that's what we did. And, you know, I come out of the social sciences. Economics is a social science. But as a dean of a business school, I kind of had that feeling that at the undergraduate level, we really don't want to be creating a bunch of specialists. We want to create generalists at the undergraduate level with a deep liberal arts background. And that was why, and the faculty bought it. So at the time.
No, and we always have discussions, but it's currently what's going on now. Now you've been active, I think you've done some expert witness testimony and things like that. And then you're also an entrepreneur on some stuff, but active outside the business school at times throughout your 50 years here. And you like coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You got good coffee.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're in. If you want to talk a little bit about the, you know, and I really like it, this notion that, you know, you're teaching business in a business school and you're leading teachers of business. You're also practicing business outside with Thomas Hammer Coffee. Mm-hmm. But if you want to talk a little bit about how that kind of came about.
Well, you know, that's a good question again. And you're asking questions I don't think I've ever been asked. I've given information on it, but I've never been asked that question.
Yeah.
I guess it maybe stems from my own family and my mother and father and growing up, because my dad was always doing things with business venture, and he had a job, but he was pretty entrepreneurial in a very minor way. In those days, entrepreneurship wasn't even a word you can pronounce, let alone spell. Right. But I tried a number of things when I was young and failed. I started a trucking company and failed. I had a little restaurant and it failed. So I had...
What was it called?
Packies.
Packies?
Yeah, Packies Restaurant.
In where?
Right here.
In Spokane. Yeah. Packies Restaurant. Whereabouts?
About a block away from where we sit today in the Jepson Center, two blocks from the Jepson Center. There was a takeover from a guy who had the restaurant, and he got out of it, and the owner said, I need someone just to take it over and run it. It was a good little restaurant, but I was busy doing other things. But I took it over full. I took it and ran it for a couple of years. And then then the university came in and bought, that's right, they bought the building. And that's now one of the dorms is where that restaurant used to be.
And you lived in the neighborhood at the time.
It was in the neighborhood, yeah.
But you lived in the neighborhood.
I lived yeah. right five blocks up the street.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I was at Gonzaga as the dean then, and David Sabe, who was on our board, had bought Northtown Shopping Mall.
Oh, wow.
And he asked me to come up, and he says, I think I would like to get some of your students to maybe help design some promotional things to kind of give people a better feel for what the value of coming to Northtown to shop. So I'm up there, and very quickly, I'll tell you, there was a store that was closed in the middle of the day. And I said, what happened? He said, well, this has been a coffee shop, and they packed up and left in the middle of the night. He said, you ought to get your students to come actually and run this coffee shop. I knew students are transitory. They're here for 2 or 3 years and gone. But I'd known Tom Hammer. He was a former student, and Tom had graduated, and he was kind of bouncing around out there looking for a job. And I got a hold of him and I said, I may have an opportunity if you're interested in a job. He said, I'd love to explore it. So we met at Northtown. I showed him the space and I said, you know, I have a job, Tom, but if you want to take a run at this, I'll put you in business and we'll see what happens. He said, I'd love to. He's very charismatic, very honest. And anyway, long story short, we opened that restaurant in 1993, just before Thanksgiving. And between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we thought we had died and gone to heaven. Christmas came and New Year's came, and all of a sudden you couldn't find a Shopper in North Dallas Mall to save your life. Yeah. We thought we were going bankrupt. And we fed it for about 3 months until Easter came. And then the foot traffic came back again. And then from there, it was just continually growing and building the business. And I credit my partner, Tom Hammer, who did not want his name on it. And I said, no, I own this company. Your name is going to be on it if you're going to run it. And then I said, here's what we're going to do. I told him, I said, you're going to buy into this and you're going to buy a percentage to where, you know, you are an owner, one of the owners. And so he and I today own the company. Yeah. But I don't work in the company. I don't draw a salary. All I do is just enjoy the fruits of the beans that get roasted and the coffee that gets made.
And are you doing all the roasting downtown?
Right here in Spokane, yeah, downtown.
And do you have like a master roaster like that?
We do. We have two significant roasters. One's a woman and one's a man.
Yeah.
And they're very, very good. And we really buy quality beans. We don't dumb that down. I remember because at one time I was buying the beans, and still to this day some, but to the brokers, I would always say, if there's a better bean out there, you need to tell me because that's what we're going to buy. I want the best beans that we can bring to Spokane. And they've been very good, and we've been good to bring really quality coffee to this camp, to the city.
How many locations?
We're at 18 now.
18, and I love your spot on Grand, on South Grand.
Thank you.
That's probably the biggest I would imagine.
It is. It's our biggest and our newest.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly good traffic.
We're in two at Sacred Heart Hospital. We're at the Sacred Heart Providence out in the valley. We have one at Deaconess, so we've got the hospitals well covered. We're at Eastern, we're at WSU, we're at University of Idaho. So we've got a good, and here at Gonzaga, we've got a good identity there. And then the rest are in commercials.
Yeah, there was some airport presence at one point.
We've just taken over what had been the Starbucks.
Okay.
And we're going to gradually take
that main terminal.
We will eventually take the main terminal. We just moved into the Alaska Airlines.
Okay, yeah.
We're there, and we'll be there. And then as they're going to remodel that rotunda in the Spokane Airport, and as it gets remodeled, we'll then move into the a site there once it's done.
Wow.
Yeah,
I heard they're doing all local in that rotunda.
Yeah.
Someone said Jack and Dan's was going to have some. Have you heard that?
No,
I didn't. I was like, I don't know. That might be sacrilegious.
I'm surprised David's Pizza will not be there. But
there you go. Yeah, David's Pizza for sure.
Yeah.
You know, Bud, when you look back on your time here, it doesn't have to be one, but what are some of the fondest memories that you think of?
Well, certainly, you know, first time out of the box to get the School of Business accredited. You know, following accreditation, I served on the accreditation committee, and I can't tell you how many times we would go to visit a school, and we would either deny accreditation or put them on a probation and give them another year or two to boost up the quality of their program to become accredited. And when we went for accreditation, we were ready and we got it the first time through. It's a little bit like taking the CPA exam. If you're really ready and you've got your ducks in order, they're going to give it to you. But if you're weak in areas, you would be denied, and we weren't. And so I was elated when we got the news that we were going to be accredited, that they had voted to accredit the school. That was a highlight for me. And then meeting Bob Jepson and then Fritz Wolf and Geish Almighty working. Those are highlights in my life. And you know what is maybe the best is the quality of relationships of former students that I have today. I mean, these are young men and women who graduated, you know, in the 70s and 80s and 90s that today, you know, they're in careers, successful careers of their own, and yet they haven't forgotten Gonzaga and School of Business. And I get notices or calls or Someone will stop by all the time. And when we had that tribute a couple of weeks ago, people flew in. Stanley Lem came, and his wife came from Honolulu. And John Resch came from Cincinnati. And Phoebe Johnston came from San Diego. I mean, this is, why would you travel that far for a lowly professor? I don't know, but they were there. And it was absolutely, those are highlights that I think, you know, are buried deep in my heart and my mind. Yeah.
You know, it's really one of the benefits of our job. And I always tell people, it's not necessarily earned on the merits. It's just the virtue of the position of being a professor and how you can help people in a real impactful way at a formative time in their life. It's pretty special. Maybe that's why people are giving up $1 million for 20% of that or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, and you're well on your way to that as well, Andrew. I've seen it. I
appreciate that.
No, I do, because I know you work very hard at helping your students find their path. And I think that's a real credit. When a faculty member will step up and make a couple of phone calls, write a couple of letters to a potential employer and position someone that they think really would be a good fit, and you do that very, very well. And I think that's beyond walking into that classroom and grading exams and giving grades. Goes far. And what we do at Gonzaga, I think, is exactly what I've seen in you, and I've seen it in so many other faculty.
Yeah, I appreciate that, especially from you, I do.
But it was to your grandfather's credit that he would do that. Every now and then he would find someone that needed help, and he would reach out.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's... And taught me a lesson. Your grandfather was a great mentor. Without necessarily seeing himself as a mentor, but watching what he did and how he did it and how students became endeared to him, it rubbed off. And I've never forgotten what a great gift he gave me in that sense of seeing how you can help students that goes beyond the classroom.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time here today, Bud. It's been fantastic. Thanks for the delicious coffee. Yeah. Grab me before we started. Keep on keeping on. Get up to the lake and enjoy it.
Thank you.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire.